do that.
Good. You're looking after that. Good. That's good. Yes, well, thank you. And thanks, obviously, to Keith and Daniele for finally gathering us together in a centre. I mean, we've been doing this for how many, like, almost 30 years, so it's really good. Yes, so it's really good. So I'm really delighted that you've pulled all this together. We've got such a great bunch of students here. Okay, so I should explain. First of all, I'm like a lot of people around. I'm not in the best of health, so sorry about that. The handout will not be needed until the sort of second part of the paper. And the reason I've given it to you is because the arguments are pretty tricky. And so I thought, and as I'm absolutely hopeless with PowerPoints and stuff, I thought I would give you this. And so you've got something to go through, because I do want to go through the argument in quite a lot of detail. Now, this is a digest of two chapters that I've sort of put together here. But this talk also reflects, I guess, something I've been trying to do with Hegel and a lot of different philosophers, and that is to try and make sense of Hegel's understanding of and critique of X, in this case Kant, while acknowledging the injustice of some of his remarks about Kant. So I'm not just going to give in and say, well, because Hegel gets Kant wrong in certain respect, that's it. But equally, there's no point, and it would be irresponsible, to overlook the fact that there are idiosyncrasies, at least, in Hegel's reading. So anyway, this is an attempt to try and show what I think are the strengths of Hegel's argument whilst also doing justice to Kant. Hegel famously considers Kant's account of the antinomies to be one of the most important parts of the Critique of Pure Reason. For the antinomies, Hegel says, I quote, brought about the downfall of previous metaphysics and can be regarded as a main transition into more recent philosophy. That's not just his own, that's Fichte, Schelling as well. For Hegel, such metaphysics, found, for example, in the work of Christian Wolff, sought to attribute predicates to objects of reason, such as the soul or the world, and it assumed in so doing that such predicates were mutually exclusive. It aimed to determine, therefore, whether the soul is simple or composite, whether the world is finite or infinite, and it did not consider the possibility that the object concerned could in fact be both. Through his examination of the antinomies, however, Kant deals a significant blow to such metaphysics, for he argues that in the case of the world, no choice between two opposing assertions can be made, but, I quote Hegel, each of the propositions must be affirmed with equal necessity. The world must be understood as finite and infinite. Kant's argument, in Hegel's view, thus puts an end to the simple either-or of pre-Kantian metaphysics, at least in the area of cosmology. Yet Kant also agrees with such metaphysics that predicates such as finite and infinite are opposed to one another and cannot be reconciled. The claim that both have to be predicated of the world with equal necessity thus in fact produces a contradiction. We must judge the world to be both finite and infinite, yet these two determinations exclude one another completely. Hegel recognizes that Kant resolves such contradiction to his own satisfaction, but he regards Kant's resolution as profoundly inadequate. This is because Kant merely declares contradiction to be, in Hegel's word, subjective. For Hegel's Kant, the contradictions revealed by the antinomies are necessary, but the world that exhibits them is not something that exists in itself. It is merely the world of our, as Hegel sees it, subjective experience, the world of appearance, die erscheinende Welt. Whatever there may be in itself is thus for Kant free of contradiction, and the latter belongs only to the world that is there for us. To Hegel, however, this resolution leaves the antinomies themselves unresolved. The contradictions remain, albeit as something subjective rather than objective. Note, by the way, that for Hegel, though not for Hegel's Kant, And by the way, we're going to be dealing with Hegel, Hegel's Kant, and Kant. So I'm going to try and keep them separate. But anyway, for Hegel, though not for Hegel's Kant, all antinomies are generated ultimately by categories. Hegel's Kant locates the source of contradiction in the application of those categories to the world regarded as a thing in itself. But for Hegel himself, Kant's antinomies demonstrate, albeit only implicitly, that, I quote, the categories on their own account, für sich, are what produce the contradiction. In order to understand the antinomies of reason properly, therefore, according to Hegel, we must focus directly on the categories, without what he regards as Kant's extraneous cosmological baggage. I don't know that he uses that phrase, but it seems a nice phrase, and it captures, I think, what Hegel thinks about the sort of cosmological dimension of Kant's argument. Now, this proper study of the antinomies of reason is, of course, what Hegel does in his Science of Logic. So that logic can be regarded as a revised and purified version of Kant's important but deficient study of the antinomies of reason, just as it can be also be regarded as a revised version of Kant's question-begging derivation or metaphysical deduction of the categories. Now, since Hegel's Kant fails to identify the categories as opposed to their application as the source of the antinomies of reason, he also fails to see that there are far more than just four such antinomies. Indeed, he fails to see, quote Hegel, that profounder insight into the antinomial, or more truly into the dialectical nature of reason, demonstrates any concept whatsoever, that is, any pure concept or category, to be a unity of opposed moments, to which, therefore, the form of antinomial assertions could be given. In this respect, Hegel claims, Kant lags behind ancient Greek skepticism, which, I quote Hegel, did not spare itself the pains of demonstrating this contradiction or antinomy in every concept which confronted it in the sciences. And yet, Kant's contribution is still the more important one for speculative philosophy. Indeed, Hegel says, it's one of the most important and profound advances of the philosophy of modern times. Because he argues not just that antinomies can be found or generated by thought as the ancient Greeks did, according to Hegel, but that they belong to reason of necessity. For Hegel, this Kantian insistence that the production of antinomies, or dialectic, is a necessary activity of reason, that's Hegel, is a crucial historical presupposition of Hegel's systematically presuppositionless philosophy. If that's baffling to you, then we can talk about it afterwards. But on my reading, Hegel thinks of philosophy as presuppositionless systematically, but it has historical presuppositions, and among those are Kant's account of the antinomies. Now, having said all of this, it's hard to deny that Hegel's understanding of Kant's antinomies from a Kantian point of view, this is not now Hegel's Kant, but Kant's Kant, is idiosyncratic. By Hegel's own admission, he sets to one side what principally interests Kant about them and focuses on a claim that Kant himself does not explicitly make, namely, that categories produce the antinomies and thereby prove to be contradictory themselves. Indeed, Hegel even says that such a claim goes against gegen Kant's intention. Moreover, what Hegel means by a category does not coincide exactly with what Kant means. Kant understands a category to be a concept through which, I quote Kant, the synthetic unity of the manifold in intuition is thought. Whereas Hegel takes categories to be logical structures in their own right that bring to mind fundamental ways of being. It seems clear, therefore, that Hegel does not do justice to Kant's antinomies in a way that Kant himself would have recognised, and that the Kant whose antinomies Hegel finds so fruitful is, in the words of Martial Giroux, an Hegelianised Kant. And yet things are a little bit more complicated than this. For as we shall see, I hope, Hegel's interpretation of Kant's antinomies is by no means wholly unjustified. In particular, Hegel sheds important light on Kant's actual arguments or proofs in the antinomies. Kant contends that the arguments in support of the thesis and antithesis in each antinomy are sophistical, insofar as they rest on an illegitimate assumption. And this assumption is simply that appearances are things in themselves, and so form a world that is independent of us, but also given to us, and that can be limited or unlimited, and so on. Yet Kant also insists that aside from this assumption, I quote Kant now, the proofs of the fourfold antinomy are not semblances, Blendwerke, but well-grounded. They are without contradiction, again Kant, and are supported by valid and necessary grounds. Thus, on the illegitimate assumption that empirical objects form an independent world in itself, the arguments in each antinomy succeed, in Kant's view, in proving that both the thesis and the antithesis are true of that world. And that's really important, and he repeats it in the Prolegomena. The problem with the arguments in the antinomies for Kant, this is Kant's Kant now, is not with the arguments themselves, but with the assumption that they both take for granted, namely that appearances are things in themselves. And if you recognize the illegitimacy of that assumption, then the arguments are fine. In Hegel's view, by contrast, such arguments are mere pseudo-proofs, Scheinbeweise, quite apart from the assumption that Kant claims they make. This is because, according to Hegel, they presuppose the very thesis and antithesis that they aim to prove, and the categories therein. Quite how each argument presupposes the very thing it's meant to prove, we'll see when we look at the second antinomy. But before that, we need to look in a bit more detail at Kant's own account of the antinomies and how they're generated. Now, if you know about Kant's antinomies, this is all going to be very familiar, and I'm sorry. If you don't, well, I'm hoping this might illuminate Kant's antinomies somewhat, because they are absolutely fascinating, there's no doubt about it. First, according to Kant, reason concludes, or perhaps it would be more accurate to say, reason leads the understanding to judge, that the totality of conditions of appearance, that is the world, is given as a reality in itself. Reason reaches this conclusion, however, through an argument that rests on two errors. The first is to assume that objects of the senses can indeed be given as a totality. Whereas in fact, as appearance, they can be given only through a regressive synthesis that can never be completed. So that's, whether or not you think of them as being something in themselves or not, for Kant, appearances cannot be given as a totality because they can only be given through a regressive synthesis, and that by its nature cannot be completed. The second error is to assume that the objects of the senses as appearances are also things in themselves, and that is the assumption that Kant calls transcendental realism. So transcendental realism is the view that appearances are not only given as a totality, but they are things in themselves, and they would be there even if we weren't there. The conclusion that the world is given as a reality in itself is thus reached by an argument that fails to respect the limits, in Kant's view, in particular to the concept of appearance, that are laid down by transcendental idealism. So, after having convinced itself, or convinced the understanding at least, that the totality of the conditions of appearances exists as a world in itself, reason then discerns an ambiguity in the very idea of such a totality. So what exactly is this ambiguity? Well, the answer becomes clear if we compare the idea of the world with the ideas of the soul and of God. Each of the latter, the soul and God, is the idea of a single, unconditioned condition, the unconditioned condition of thought in the case of the soul, and the unconditioned condition of all possible objects of thought in the case of God. But the idea of the world is not that of a single unconditioned condition. It's that of a totality of conditions conceived as a series. More precisely, it's the thought, the idea of the world is the thought of the complete series of conditions of appearances. Now, Kant maintains that a totality of conditions is always itself unconditioned. That's a quotation. But he points out that the complete series of conditions of appearances can in fact be conceived as unconditioned or as entailing the unconditioned in two distinct ways. This is an ambiguity inherent in the idea of the world, but absent from the ideas of the soul and God, which is why, by the way, Hegel is wrong to say that for Kant there should be antinomies just as much produced by the soul and God. No, the antinomies are distinct, are specifically generated by an ambiguity in the conception of the world. So that ambiguity consists in the fact that on the one hand, the series as a whole can be regarded as unconditioned. But on the other hand, the series can be understood to have the unconditioned as its first member. In the first case, when the series as the whole is regarded as unconditioned, there is no unconditioned first member. The series will therefore be infinite, in what Hegel thinks is a bad sense, but nonetheless, infinite in the sense of endless, and without limits. Accordingly, reason will never be able to complete its regress through the conditions, even though the series itself is given as a totality. So that's the case when we think of the world as an unconditioned totality. It doesn't have any member that's unconditioned. It is unconditioned as a whole, but even though it's given as a totality, we would regress through it endlessly. In the second case, by contrast, the series will have an end point or limit, and in that sense be finite. And that limit will be the limit of space and time, or the point at which division ends, or the unconditioned free course of events, or the necessary being, depending on the antinomy concerned. Now, Kant goes on to argue not just that the complete series of conditions of appearances, the world, can, but that it must be understood in these two opposing ways. And when the thought of this necessary duplicity at the heart of the idea of the world is combined with the assumption that the complete series actually exists as something in itself, then the antinomies are generated. So you've got to distinguish between transcendental realism, which is the idea that appearances are given as a totality, as something in themselves, and distinguish that from this ambiguity in the very idea of the world. The fact that the idea of the world can be understood as unconditioned as a series or as having an unconditioned first member. And it's only when you put that ambiguity together with transcendental realism that you get antinomies. So the ambiguity is not yet an antinomy. So a genuine antinomy then, or contradiction, is not produced by the mere thought that the world is ambiguous in the way I've just described it. It arises only when we take that ambiguous world of appearances to be a reality in itself that must be unambiguous. That's when you get an antinomy. So what transcendental realism brings with it is the idea that appearances constitute a world that is something in itself, and Kant thinks that that idea brings with it the idea that there is no ambiguity. It's got to be this or that. And yet, the very idea of a world has an ambiguity in it. And it's when reason is put in the position of having to predicate two opposing predicates of something that is meant to be unambiguous, that's when you get an antinomy or a contradiction. So antinomies arise, therefore, only because we combine conflicting judgments about the world with the error of transcendental realism. Now, for Kant, reality as it's thought to be in itself cannot be contradictory or antinomial, but must be unambiguously itself. Indeed, I quote Kant, no predicate pertains to a thing that contradicts it, whether the thing is a thing in itself or an appearance. Yet, when the world, the complete series of conditions of empirical objects, is judged to be a reality in itself, it proves precisely to be contradictory, because the world has this ambiguity in it. Since the arguments proving the world to be contradictory are sound, given the assumption that such a world exists, the conclusion we must draw is that that assumption must be wrong, and that the world cannot be anything real in itself after all. It must rather be an idea that merely seems to have a real existence of its own. So if you take the world to be something that exists in itself, and you add in the ambiguity that belongs to the very idea of the world, you end up with the antinomy, which is produced by the fact that you have one world that's unambiguously itself, and that is simultaneously finite and infinite, even though those are mutually exclusive. And Kant thinks the fact that that assumption of transcendental realism produces that contradiction, and that contradictions can't belong to reality, therefore, the world can't exist. There is no such world, Kant will say. That's the problem. That's where transcendental realism goes wrong. It thinks of the totality, well, it thinks of appearances, first of all, as a totality, and then as a totality that's actually given, and it's wrong on both counts. And if you take away that transcendental realism, if you abandon the idea that the world is something in itself, then you're just left with the ambiguity in the idea of the world. But that doesn't produce an antinomy for Kant, because the ambiguity is not predicated of anything, because there isn't anything there to predicate it of. So, if we give up transcendental realism, Kant thinks we're committed to transcendental idealism, and so the antinomies provide an indirect, not a direct, but an indirect proof of transcendental idealism. Now, what's doing all the work here, clearly, is the idea that reality in itself can't be contradictory. Because, of course, if reality could be contradictory, then what would be the problem? You could have a reality that was unambiguously this or that, and at the same time, ambiguously, both this and not this. But Kant doesn't like the idea that the world could be contradictory. So we have to withdraw transcendental realism and retreat to transcendental idealism. But Kant never justifies the claim that reality in itself cannot contain a contradiction. He just takes it over uncritically from traditional formal logic. For Kant, it's simply obvious that reality can't be contradictory. Where contradiction is found, therefore, there can be no reality. And this, I take it, is why Hegel accuses Kant of showing too great a tenderness, Zärtlichkeit, towards things. In Hegel's view, Kant deserves qualified credit for maintaining that reason generates antinomies, but he deserves censure for insisting, without clear justification, that reality as it is thought to be and as it is judged actually to be, in itself, must be free of all contradiction. Now, of course, Kant's not alone in thinking that reality must be free of all contradiction, but Hegel doesn't accept that assumption. And so he accuses Kant then of just this tenderness towards the world. Because Kant sees how reason generates this contradiction and then kind of withdraws from the implications of that by saying, oh, well, there isn't really a world that could be contradictory in that way, precisely because it proves to be contradictory when you assume it exists. As we've seen, there's a necessary tension in the idea of a complete series of conditions of appearances, since it can and must be conceived both as unconditioned itself, and so as unlimited and infinite, and as containing an unconditioned first member, and so limited and finite. A strict antinomy or contradiction arises, however, only when that complete series is taken actually to be something real in itself. That is, when we commit the error of transcendental realism. For only in that case are we required to attribute two mutually exclusive characteristics to a reality that must be one or the other. If, therefore, we abandon the idea that this complete series constitutes something real in itself in favour of transcendental idealism, then the antinomies are removed immediately. If the reality that proves contradictory is eliminated, then the contradiction it produces itself disappears. Accordingly, for the critical or transcendental idealist, I quote Kant, there is no real contradiction of reason. Because there's no determinate totality, no world, about which two mutually exclusive judgments must be made. Such a world is a mere mirage, a blendwerk. The thesis and antithesis of each antinomy remained opposed to one another, but they're not actually about anything, and so they produce no contradiction. The conflict in each antinomy is thus in truth not a contradiction, but what Kant calls a dialectical conflict, one that merely seems to be a contradiction. This is because the world that is its subject is itself an illusion. That's Kant. And yet, having said all of this, things are actually a little bit more complicated than I've just indicated, and this is going to be the sort of Hegelian bit that's coming in now. For the conflict that's generated by the illusory world cannot just be seemingly contradictory. This is because the world, as Kant understands it, retains exactly the same characteristics when it is reduced to mere illusion as it had when it was judged to be real in itself. It must still be understood to be both finite and infinite, and to have a determinate character that is unambiguously finite or infinite. Accordingly, this illusory world must itself give rise to an actual contradiction. There is no contradiction in the world itself, since there is no such world. Yet there is still a contradiction in the world there seems to be, since the thesis and antithesis still apply necessarily to that world, but the latter cannot be characterized by both of them together. When the world is exposed as an illusion, therefore, the conflict between the thesis and antithesis does not just prove to be seemingly contradictory, it remains a genuine contradiction besetting the world there merely seems to be. Kant doesn't make this point himself, and he wouldn't like the thought that he was committed to it. But I think it's implicit in what Kant says. And in this sense, it seems to me, Hegel is right to claim that Kant's solution to the antinomies, I quote Hegel, makes the so-called conflict into something subjective, in which, of course, it remains still the same illusion, that is, as unresolved as before. However, I have to admit, I don't think Hegel has in mind exactly the point that I'm making, although I'm making it in the spirit of Hegel, it seems to me. And the reason why I think Hegel doesn't make that point directly himself is that Hegel thinks that Kant shifts contradictions from things in themselves to the realm of appearance, Erscheinung. But this claim is clearly mistaken. For in Kant's view, there is no contradiction in mere appearances. Appearances, the realm of empirical objects that we experience, Kant never says that there's contradiction in that realm. Nonetheless, if I'm right, reason's illusory world must continue to produce contradictions, even if Kant does not admit as much himself. And in this respect, it seems to me there is truth in Hegel's claim that Kant turns contradiction into something subjective, but otherwise leaves it unresolved. It's just that the contradiction attaches not to the realm of appearance, Erscheinung, as Hegel thinks, but to the illusion, the Schein, that's projected by reason. So in that respect, I would argue that there is justice to Hegel's critique of Kant, although you've got to do a little bit of jinking and weaving to get there, because there's also a lot of injustice in Hegel's critique of Kant. Okay, now that was the easy bit. So now we're going to look at the second antinomy. So now the handout will become relevant. Now, I also want to argue that not only has Hegel got something interesting to say about Kant's antinomies in general, and I've sort of explained why that is, but that actually Hegel's claim that Kant's proofs are deficient because they presuppose the very thing they're supposed to prove is really, really powerful. Now, most people don't pay any attention to this because you've got to read through large bits of the logic to get there. But I think that this is really the core of Hegel's critique of Kant. I'm focusing on the second antinomy, by the way, because it's the one Hegel has most to say about. In the logic, he makes reference to the first and the second antinomies. The third and the fourth really concern other issues, and so they're not discussed there. Right, now, this is quite complicated, so I'm going to go through it several times, and I hope I don't try your patience in so doing. Anyway, Kant's second antinomy concerns the divisibility of things. And the thesis is this: every composite substance in the world consists of simple parts, and nothing exists anywhere except the simple or what is composed of the simples. The apagogic proof of this thesis proceeds as follows. Now, you've got the Kant's text. I'm not going to read Kant's text. But what I am going to do is go through the stages of the argument. And what I've done is assign a number to each of those stages. And I've put the number by the relevant sentence in the quotation. So you can read the quotations there, so you can actually make reference to it if you want to. But I'm going to go through where it says one, assume first. That's going to go through the stages of the argument. So this is the argument to prove the thesis. And the thesis is that every composite is composed of simples. And so ultimately simples is what there are. Assume first that composite substances do not consist of simple parts, and that all there is what is composite. So to prove the thesis, you assume first the antithesis. Stage two. If we were then to remove all composition in thought, there would clearly be nothing left. All composite parts would disappear with composition, and we've assumed that there's nothing simple, therefore nothing at all would be left over. This in turn means, number three, that no substance would have been given in the first place, since Kant tacitly assumes substance as such cannot be removed. Number four, the idea that no substance was ever given is, however, nonsensical and absurd, unacceptable, since the assumption from which we began is precisely that there are composite substances. The terms nonsensical and unacceptable, by the way, are Michel Greer's, since Kant takes the point to be so obvious he doesn't even spell it out. Which is why in the quotation, four and five are in the brackets there in line four, without corresponding sentences. Because Kant doesn't even, these things are so obvious to him, he doesn't even need to say them. Five, it is impossible, therefore, for us to be left with nothing at all. Accordingly, there are only two alternatives. 5a, either composition cannot be removed in thought after all but is irreducible. Or 5b, composition can be removed, but after its removal, something must be left over that subsists without any composition. The simple. And of course, that's the thesis Kant wants to prove. Six, in the case of 5a, however, the composite would not consist of substances. That's Kant. And the reason is that substances are such that composition can always be removed from them because, quote Kant, composition is only a contingent relation of substances apart from which, as beings persisting by themselves, they must subsist. The thought, the consequence of 5a, that the composite does not consist of substances, is however directly at odds with our initial presupposition, namely that there are composite substances. 5a must therefore be rejected, which leaves only 5b, namely that what is a substantial composite in the world consists of simple parts. So the thesis has thus been proven by showing that its opposite is self-contradictory and impossible. Now, this proof is pretty intricate, and if you're like me, you won't have the foggiest idea what it's about on first reading. I mean, it took me reading it sort of about 10 times to work out what was going on. So forgive me if I go through it one more time. In fact, there won't just be one more time. We're seeking to prove the thesis that every composite substance consists of simple parts. and that ultimately there are only simples in the world. So we start with the antithesis, and we assume that there are no simples, but only composite substances. Then we think away all composition. Now it's clear that in so doing, we've thought away all there is, because we've started from the assumption that there are no simples, but only composites. So if we think away all composition, we've got rid of everything. There's nothing left. But according to Kant, there can't be just nothing left. We can't be left with nothing, because what we started with were precisely composite substances. And Kant assumes tacitly that substances can't be removed. So if there can't be nothing, then we have two alternatives. Either our initial strategy was wrong and we can't think away composition at all, or we can indeed think away composition, but then in that case there must be something left, namely simples. The second option is the thesis we're trying to prove. So Kant's just got to show that the first option is unintelligible and absurd. If he can get rid of that, then we're left with a thesis, and bingo, we've got what we need. So let's consider the first option. We cannot think away composition. Kant thinks this is impossible, since it would mean, he says, that the composite would not consist of substances. So if we were to think away all composition, then the composite would not consist of substances. Why? Because composition is, I quote Kant, and I'll quote this several times, only a contingent relation between substances, and so can always be removed from them. To repeat, for Kant, composition can always be removed from substances. So if you argue that composition cannot be removed from substances, then you're not thinking of composition as belonging to substances at all. But that's at odds with the initial assumption, namely that there are precisely composite substances. So the first option A has to be rejected. You can't think away composition and be left with nothing, because substances can't just be got rid of like that. So we have these two options. Either we cannot think away composition at all, or we can and we're left with simples. If you claim that you can't think away composition at all, then you're not thinking of composition as a relation between substances. Because Kant says that composition as a relation between substances is external to them. It consists of substances and so can always be removed. So if you're thinking of composition as something that can't be removed, you're not thinking of it as a composite of substances. But our whole premise is that we're thinking of composite substances. So that's just an absurdity. That's not an easy argument to get your mind around. But remember, aside from the assumption of transcendental realism, Kant thinks that is a well-grounded argument. Okay, a couple of things, one thing to notice here. There is an ambiguity in the concept of a composite substance. The German for composite substance is zusammengesetzte Substanz, a put-together substance. And in the singular, this simply suggests the idea of a substance that is composite in itself. But the plural suggests both substances that are composite in themselves and substances that have been put together to form composites. Now, Kant evidently equates these two. So in Kant's mind, a composite substance is just a composite of substances. My view is it's not obvious at the start of the proof that this should be the case. But it becomes obvious in the course of the proof, and this has, I would argue, fatal consequences for the argument. And in what's now going to follow, I'm drawing on Hegel, so I'm not claiming originality, but I'm not going to quote him all the time, just to save time. So again, if you'll bear with me just to go through it one more time. The beginning of the proof initially seems unproblematic. Substance is taken to be thoroughly composite. And so all there is held to be are composites. This is explained or expressed in the statement, point one, that composite substances do not consist of simple parts. The argument from point two to five then goes like this. If all that exists are composites and you remove composition in thought, you remove everything and you leave nothing. But substance cannot be removed. So removing composition means that the composites were not actually substances to start with, that no substance would have been given, and that we were initially confronted with non-substantial composites. But this is absurd, since the assumption from which we began is precisely that we're faced with composite substances. So we can't remove all composition and still be left with the idea that what we have is a composite of substances. We're forced to choose between two alternatives. Either substances are composite through and through, and so composition cannot be removed, or substances are not thoroughly composite, but have simple parts. And composition can be removed in that case, and we're left with simples. Kant wants to get to that second view, so he focuses his attention on the first. So, what would follow if we think that composition cannot be removed? Well, Kant says, I repeat again, in that case, the composite would not consist of substances. And the reason he gives, again, I'll quote, composition is a contingent relation of substances apart from which they must subsist. So, in the case of substances, composition is necessarily something that can be removed. Thus, if composition can't be removed, the composite cannot consist of substances. Kant then argues that this conclusion, that the composite can't consist of substances, contradicts the assumption of the whole proof. And it's at this point in the proof that we realise that what Kant means by a composite substance is precisely a composite of substances. It's not clear earlier on, but it becomes clear at this point when he argues that this idea contradicts what we began with. Now, you might wonder, why on earth does all this matter? What's it got to do with anything? Well, it matters for the following reason. Because the assertion, as Kant presents it in point six, that a composite consists of substance, amounts to the assertion that it consists of simple substances. But that is precisely the thesis that is to be proven. It's supposed to be the conclusion of the whole argument, but Kant slips it in a parenthesis, in point six, in the course of arguing towards what is supposed to be the conclusion. And that basically is why Hegel thinks this is question begging. Let's consider six in more detail. As we've seen, Kant justifies the claim that an irreducible composite would not consist of substances, by explaining what it means for a composite to consist of substances. In the latter case, to quote it for the millionth time, composition is only a contingent relation of substances, apart from which, as beings persisting by themselves, they must subsist. So when composites consist of substances, those substances must be able to exist without forming a composite. A composite of substances is precisely a composite of substances that can exist without forming a composite. Accordingly, composition must be something that can be removed from them, contra 5a. But if composition is not an irreducible feature of substances, then they in turn must themselves be simples. But that's the thesis that is to be proven. So the thesis that all composites are made up of simples doesn't just appear at the end of the argument as its conclusion. But in fact, it's inserted into the proof in a parenthesis, and Hegel notes this, as if Kant hadn't even thought it was that significant. He just slips it in a parenthesis, as a self-evident assumption. This is the assumption that composition is an external contingent relation between substances. Indeed, Kant could not get to the conclusion that composites are made of simples unless he slips it in point six. Because slipping it in point six is what enables him to show that point 5a is untenable, and that's what leads to point 5b. So the reason why, out of those two options, the two options are, remember, composition cannot be removed, or composition can be removed, and therefore what are left are simples. The first one, composition cannot be removed, for Kant, is at odds with the very idea of a composite of substances. Because for a composite of substances, you can always remove composition. So we have to get rid of that. We have to get rid of that idea that composition cannot be removed, on the assumption that composition can always be removed. So that gets rid of 5a, frees us up for 5b, which is the thesis. But the condition he's laying down in getting rid of 5a is already the thesis. The thesis is already that composition is an external relationship between substances that can always be removed, leaving what? Simple substances. So in the course of the argument, Kant is smuggling in the thesis at a point prior to the conclusion. Sorry, that's complicated and difficult, but it matters because it shows that I think Hegel is right, that the problem with Kant's proof is that it's question begging. It pretends to be apagogic by starting with the antithesis to prove the thesis, but in the course of the proof, it actually takes the thesis for granted in order to get to the conclusion. So it's a Scheinbeweis. It's a pseudo-proof. But Kant thought it was good, aside from the assumption of transcendental idealism. Now, the antithesis is a bit easier, so I'll try and get through that a bit more quickly. Again, you've got the quotation. I'm not going to read it. I'm just going to go through the stages of the argument. All right. So now what we're trying to prove is the antithesis, namely that no composite thing in the world consists of simple parts, and nowhere in it does there exist anything simple. So we now assume first that composite things do consist of simple parts. Then two, we then note that composition is possible only in space. Three, we then note that therefore there must be as many parts in space as in the composite itself. Then Kant argues space, however, does not consist of simple parts but of spaces. Each part of a composite must therefore occupy a space. But remember, the assumption we've made in this proof is that the parts of a composite are simple. So according to the argument we've just given, the simple has to occupy a space. Eight, but everything real that occupies a space contains a manifold of elements and so is a composite. But this leads us to the conclusion that the simple must be a substantial composite. Kant says that's contradictory. So the assumption we've begun with leads to a contradiction, ergo that assumption is wrong. And so we're left with a proof for the antithesis. Now, Hegel notes that there are a number of assumptions here, and the fact that there are assumptions doesn't necessarily mean they're wrong, but they function as assumptions in the proof. And these are point two, that composites are only possible in space. Point four, that space does not consist of simple parts, but rather of spaces. And that point eight, that everything real occupying a space contains a manifold of elements. But Hegel thinks that these assumptions together already directly assert the antithesis. For they state precisely that space and the composite things in it, which are the only composites there can be, have no simple parts. So the thesis proves to be contradictory and so makes the antithesis necessary, only because the antithesis is itself taken for granted in the first place in the course of the proof. So again, Hegel claims that the so-called apagogical proof is just, in Hegel's words, a baseless illusion. Yes, Kant does begin with the thesis, but then he simply asserts the antithesis in those points 2, 4, and 8, and on that basis proves that the thesis leads to contradiction, which in turn proves the antithesis. So he proves the antithesis by taking it for granted in the course of the proof. I'll just read you, this is the last quotation, I think, on the handout. This is Hegel, the assumption that everything substantial is spatial and that space does not consist of simple parts is a direct assertion, which is made the immediate ground of what is to be proved, and with it the whole proof is already finished. But it's more complicated even than that, because Hegel thinks that as soon as the proponent of the antithesis agrees that composition is an external relationship between substances that therefore can happen only in space, he's actually committed to the very thesis he aims to disprove. So the previous point was, we're trying to prove the antithesis, but in the course of doing, we take the antithesis for granted. Hegel's point now is, in the course of proving the antithesis, Hegel actually takes the thesis for granted. And he takes the thesis for granted in the very idea that composition is something external that can only happen in space. Because if composition is external to substances, they must in themselves be simple. But that's the thesis. So in fact, the proof of the antithesis not only proves the antithesis by assuming it, it also proves the thesis at the same time. And this is why Hegel thinks that you cannot actually have an antinomy generated by composition. This is the heart of it. Hegel thinks the very notion of composition does not generate an antinomy, because the very notion of composition is always the composite of simple substances. But does this mean that Kant's whole endeavour here is a complete waste of time? No, because Hegel thinks that Kant is doing something else implicitly in the proof of the antithesis, which he's not completely consistent about. And what he's doing is pitting not just composition against simplicity, because they're both sides of the same coin. He's pitting continuity against simplicity. Because when Kant says that, whatever the exact wording was, again, number four, space does not consist of simple parts, but rather of spaces. Hegel thinks what Kant is invoking there is his own considered understanding of space from the transcendental aesthetic, namely that space is continuous. But the problem is that Kant doesn't sustain that idea, so by the time we get down to eight again, we've gone back to the idea that space is a manifold, a composite. So in fact, there's an inconsistency, a confusion in the proof of the antithesis, where Kant moves from one conception of space to another, beginning with the idea of space as a composite, but then moving implicitly to the idea of space as continuity, and then back to the idea of space as a composite again. Hegel thinks that there can be and there must be an antinomy between continuity and simplicity, because those are the two moments of quantity. Quantity for Hegel is the unity of continuity and discreteness. And clearly, given that quantity unites those two different moments, you can isolate them in contrary assertions and so generate an antinomy. But you can't generate an antinomy out of the idea of composition, because a composition by its nature is a composition of simples. So in fact, there is something very important in Kant's proof of the antithesis in the second antinomy. And this is why Hegel is so interested in it. Now, again, Hegel doesn't like the cosmological baggage, so he wants to get rid of all of that. But he thinks his own account in The Logic of Quantity of the relationship between continuity and discreteness resolves the second antinomy when you think of the second antinomy as pitting continuity against simplicity as opposed to composition against simplicity. Hegel's solution, just very briefly and then I'll finish, involves showing that continuity as continuity is not already divided into discrete units, but is divisible into discrete units in the manner suggested by Aristotle in his critique of Zeno's paradoxes. And Hegel credits Aristotle with this idea. He doesn't necessarily claim it as his own insight. So the continuous is always divisible into the discrete, but the discrete itself always constitutes a continuity, since the discrete in their very discreteness continue in those that lie beyond them. So discreteness itself generates continuity, if only the continuity of the discrete. So you can't have one without the other. And in fact, these categories are sort of slightly odd because each is a moment of the other. Continuity is always the continuity of the discrete, and the discrete is always discrete as continuity. So continuity and discreteness are not ultimately opposed to one another, but are moments of one another, and indeed they constitute the basis of quantity. That is Hegel's logical resolution of the antinomy that he thinks Kant is sort of implicitly presenting between these two aspects. This resolution, however, is not going to satisfy Kant. And Hegel surely knows that. But then what Hegel's interested in is a resolution that satisfies speculative reason. He's not so worried if it doesn't satisfy Kantian understanding, and we can be pretty sure that it wouldn't. Okay, thank you.